Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
So here's the drill for tonight. I've got a batch of clips that we've been selecting over the last day or two. They come from a particular feature that's tucked away someplace on our website called Three Decades Retrospective. And that covers the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s. We haven't got around to the 2000s yet, but we must do that. I have reminded myself. And I've got these in front of me, and I decided the first one we wanted to play, of course, is something directly related to sports on WGN and with a significant Chicago sports figure. That was Lou Boudreau, who was in the color position in our baseball broadcasts for many years. Before that, he was, of course, a great baseball player, a shortstop, the youngest manager in the big leagues at one time when he managed the Cleveland Indians, he being at the advanced age, I think, of 22 when he started. And pitching for him shortly after he took over was a 17-year-old. Can you believe that? A 17-year-old named Bob Feller, who was one of the great pitchers in the whole history of American baseball. Back in 1990, we sat down with Bob Feller, Lou Boudreau, and another great baseball man, namely Jerry Holtzman, who was with the Tribune for many years on the baseball beat, then became the official historian for the major leagues. And we chatted about, what do you think, baseball.
Amazing when I talk with old ballplayers, I don't mean old, but veteran ballplayers, as the two of you are, that you've got almost absolute perfect recall for every game you've ever been in. Lou arrived first tonight, and we were old buddies, and we were sitting around chatting, and you came up with about five or six different games, and you could remember virtually every strike.
Well, almost, Bill. I can remember baseball very well, but I can't tell you what I had for breakfast this morning, but if you put it in the nine-inning game, I probably could.
Since your memory is just about at letter perfect or strike and ball perfect for every ball game you've ever been in, do you remember the opening game of the 1940 season?
Yes, I do.
What can you tell us about that?
Well, it was very cold. And, of course,
it
was here in Comiskey Park, yeah. And this is the 50th anniversary of a great performance by Bob Feller. There was only about two balls that was hit hard off of Bob. And there was perhaps two or three outstanding plays to help him get the no-hitter and pitching no-hitter in weather about 35, 33 degrees.
Is there one other opening day no-hitter on the record books?
No.
No, this is the only one.
That's the only one.
It's the only one, and probably will be the only one in the history of the game of baseball.
I would think so.
Bob perhaps has a thorough memory of that particular game. I know Taft Wright was at bat for the last out, and Taft was a very good hitter.
Taft was a tough hitter for me. He was when he was with Washington Senators, and he was when he came over here. He was kind of a little round man, and always kidded about Taft when he ran as best he could. He could run fairly fast. Mm-hmm. He looked like a runaway beer barrel going downhill. And well, that game, I got the bases full in the second inning, and one of the manager walked out, or one of the coaches, and said something to me, and then I struck out the hitter 3-2. I think it was Bob Kennedy, if I'm not wrong. Could be. But I struck the hitter out, and I was in a jam. I was wild. Nothing happened much till after that. I know Roy Weatherly dropped a fly ball in center somewhere along the way and went for an error. And then Appling came up with two men out in the ninth. And before that, in the fourth inning, my roommate Jeff Heath got a single, and Raleigh Hemsley, my catcher, hit a triple up the alley in right center, scored a run. So Appling's up there. He fouls off three or four, and it counts 2-2, and I throw two pitches outside on purpose. Nobody knew it but me. They weren't very far outside. I wanted to get rid of him, even though Taft Wright was coming up. I wanted to get Luke out of there. He was beginning to time me pretty well. And so he hit a tremendous shot at Ray Mack to his left. He knocks the ball down. The ball rolls about 5 feet away. He dives on it like a cat after a mouse, grabs it and turns around to his left, 360-degree turn, and fires at Trotsky at first. He had Taft by about a step. It wasn't all that close, but I put the winning run on, tying run on, I should say, which is not all that bright, but I wanted to get rid of Appling, who was a very fine ball player, Hall of Famer, and a good, excellent hitter.
Jerry, that's still a little before your time, isn't it?
Well, no.
Were you in the stadium that time?
Well, no, I wasn't writing then, but I was watching baseball. This was in 1940.
Right, yeah.
And I was in high school, almost in high school at that time.
That was the only game, and that was my first opening day game with the major leagues. And it's the only game in my career, I never let it happen again, that I said to myself in the ninth inning with two outs, please let that ball be hit to somebody else. I didn't want any part of it.
Well, Lou, but you came back in 1946 and DiMaggio grounded out to you with, with the tying run on second in Yankee Stadium, and you made a great play on DiMaggio's ball in the hole and fired him out. With he had a 3-2 count on him, and that was in Yankee Stadium. That wound up to be a no-hitter, too. And, of course, you made the great play in that game on the leadoff man. I think it was Rizzuto that hit the ball over my head, a big high hopper, and you came in right behind the mound and grabbed the ball and barehanded and fired to first and did a, rolled over a couple of somersaults and got a play at first base. And that was the toughest play of that ball game, and you saved that. That was a hit. There would be no error charge to anybody on that one.
That was the 1-0 game that Frankie Hayes, your battery mate, hit the home run.
Let me pose a question to all three of you to kind of take a whack at. Think about baseball then. Let's say go to the immediate post-war years and baseball now. I know what the differences are in terms of salary and so on. Apart from that difference, what are the differences, Jerry, in terms of the attitudes of the players, the kinds of inner life of the teams and so on?
Well, I can only tell you, you know, mostly the differences of the players in regard to their relationship with sports writers.
That's an important part of the game.
With traveling baseball writers, I think that it was a much more a peaceable situation then. There wasn't the baseball writer and the baseball player, unfortunately, it's, there's always somewhat of an adversarial relationship, but it's much more pronounced now than it was 20 and 30 years
ago.
What
accounts for that?
Well, players are much more independent. They're already paid. They have multi-year contracts. It doesn't really matter what anybody says about them. It doesn't really matter even what they do.
They don't need the good coverage from the sports writers.
That's right. They don't need the good press, so to speak. They're already signed for the next 3 years.
Did you realize that you catch this? This program was recorded, was done in 1990. For most of that excerpt of 5.5 minutes, they're talking about a game played, the opener in the season for 1940. Pitch by pitch, ball by ball, strikeout by strikeout, they're talking about, in complete detail, a game played 50 years earlier. Speaking of good memory, you remember the things you really care about, obviously. I'm going to play you something else instantly, which also relates to sports on WGN. There was a great program here called The Sports Writers. It faded away or went onto television quite a number of years ago. Ben Bentley was the host, and a number of other recognizable figures in sports broadcasting were regular guests. And here they are in a very special version.
Maybe we ought to leave the decision, or at least turn the chair over to another WGN character who isn't here, hasn't been in the conversation until now, but has just walked in the door, and is very good at chairing meetings of this sort or any sort, Mr. Ben Bentley.
Thank you, Milt Rosenberg.
Will you get on with it, Ben? Every introduction takes a half hour. Every week, every show.
You see, I lost control. I just started already.
Now you're going to pause for a break. We haven't said anything yet.
The opinions expressed by this panel are not necessarily those of WGN. And welcome, one and all, to the Sports Writer.
The show's already over. He's been talking for a half hour.
I don't like when you criticize Benny like that. Benny does the best he can. And I wish you wouldn't criticize. Oh, come on, Phil Jouse. What are you guys always yelling for?
Jouse, how come you're in the studio? We don't know you without a phone.
Trying to quiet you down. That's what I'm here for.
Quiet me down. Quiet Bentley down. He does a 15-minute introduction on a 10-minute show every week.
All I wanted to do, Gleason.
We can't go back to Binion's.
I wanted to welcome people to our Wednesday edition of the Sports Writers, and that's precisely what I did.
But, Mr. Bentley, we've got a decision to make.
Well, I turn to the rest of the panel. I turn to Gleason. Now, Gleason's the guy who...
Now you turn to me. Before, you were busy giving the monologue about how we're not responsible for what we're about to say.
Well,
now you come to me.
I'm just in charge of welcoming people.
All right. I'm welcoming Irv Kupson. If that's the decision, we're both working again.
I think you should say welcome one and all, Ben.
One and all. Welcome to the sports world.
Well, Mr. Kupson, before we actually decide to hire you, I'd like like to learn a little bit more about you. Just who are you exactly?
Well, I'm, of course, the columnist who puts the names in the bold print, so you don't have to waste your time running down. You can just pick out those names. Say, if you want to read about Barbara, I Dream of Jeannie Eden.
Yeah,
well, I put her name in bold print, and you don't have to read about Bill Magic Kiss Gage if you don't want to. I mean, his name is in bold print, too, but you can just skim right over him. I make it easy for the people. I do the same thing for the listeners. Just bold, talking bold about important things, and then, of course, letting the other things just slide by in small print analogies.
The real Sports Writers program is gone. And, of course, those were the great mimics who did a lot of programs with us back in the 70s and the 80s. Don Fogel, Wayne Julin, and Don Kennedy. Unhappily, two of them, the two Dons, are gone as well. But that was great fun and wonderful imitation, wonderful mimicry. Ben Bentley really sounded like that, but was a charming and delightful fellow who knew everything about sports, as did the others, as did certainly Bill Jouse and Bill Gleason. We are about to pause for a quick round of commercials. We're keeping the lines open tonight in this hour. Any quick comment you want to make in response to what you've just heard, get in there very quickly at 312-591-7200. And as calls come in, if they're relevant, we'll intersperse them with some of the clips that we're playing. 312-591-7200. We go on to matters political. In fact, we talk about how Harry Truman got the nomination for the presidency with David McCullough, the great David McCullough, the best popular historian writing in America today. And you'll hear that and a good deal else, including a conversation with Margaret Thatcher, all to follow.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
What you're hearing tonight are clips drawn from the vast files of the past history of the program, and literally hundreds and hundreds of former programs are available to you just with a click of your mouse. That is, if you simply go to the webpage for this program, which is wgnradio.com/extension720. On the first page, you'll find a number of recent programs. Everything we do goes up and lingers for a week or 10 days before it gets filed back on a later page. But also on the first page, you'll find loads of classic Extension 720 programs. We keep alternating those as well. And wherever you see a line that says more podcasts, if you click on that, it takes you to the other pages in this vast file. If you need a WGN Extension 720 fix some night and don't have WGN Extension 720 available, all you need to do is go to wgnradio.com/extension720 and choose what you want for direct streaming or, for that matter, for downloading through whatever download technology you employ. I promised you David McCullough, one of my very favorite guests, is coming back in a few months with a new book. And this was the first one that brought him to popular national attention, though he had done a number of fine books before it. I speak of his biography of Harry Truman, titled simply Truman. And here's an excerpt from our conversation about that book back in 1992.
I've got a dilemma tonight. I wish we had the full 2 hours. We don't. We've got some commercials that will be coming in a while. And there's so much we could talk about. This is a superb book. Truman by David McCullough is published by Simon & Schuster. It is literally over 1,000 pages long, but it is utterly readable and entrancing on every page, full of rich anecdotes, full of character, characterological insights, and full of historical insight. I don't know. What's your choice? Shall we talk about the early shaping of Harry Truman, or should we put him into the presidency right away?
Let's put him in the presidency.
All right. Then the crucial question is, how does he get there? We know that he's chosen by Roosevelt, or at least he's chosen at the Democratic Convention in 1940.
He's really chosen by the big bosses in 1940.
Rather than Roosevelt.
Yes. Well, Roosevelt agreed to go along with the choice, if that's what they wanted. He is a product of the smoke-filled room, which is an indication, it seems to me, that the smoke-filled room wasn't altogether a bad thing.
Apparently not.
Well,
they gave us Harding, and they gave us...
They gave us room, but also you've got to remember that too, Milt. It's very important that the boss system, the bosses picked Teddy Roosevelt to be governor of New York. The bosses picked Woodrow Wilson, the president of Princeton University, to be the governor of New Jersey. The bosses were very important to the political power of Franklin Roosevelt, and the bosses helped create Jack Kennedy.
Well, the two leading candidates for vice presidency at that time were the incumbent vice president George Wallace and Jimmy Burns.
Yes, who both was then, were very ambitious to get the nomination.
And why did the bosses didn't want either of them? Wallace, because he was a little fey, so to speak.
He was too left-wing.
And too left-wing.
And he had no capacity to be one of the boys.
And Byrne was a deep South Southerner, and thus would give them trouble with the Negro vote, as they called it then, that they were counting upon.
That's right. And he was very, very conservative. He was a very able man.
Oh, yeah, Secretary of State.
And Wallace, for all his eccentricities, was quite remarkable.
But they settled on Truman because he was dependable, I suppose.
Well, he was a good, solid, professional politician with an excellent record in the Senate, and everybody liked him. He came from a border state. He had a good war record. He was a solid citizen. And you
suggest in the book as well that the bosses really thought that Roosevelt wouldn't make it through his fourth term.
No question.
Because they were selecting not merely a vice president, but
the
president to be.
That's right. And one of the misconceptions about Truman, and then there are several, is that he was an accidental president. He wasn't accidental at all. They knew very well that when they were nominating the vice president at the 44 convention, that they were nominating the next president. That he would be president probably very soon.
And you also reveal that he resisted and really tried to avoid the nomination.
He didn't want it. He didn't want to be president. And he didn't want to be president after Franklin Roosevelt.
Yeah.
He didn't want to follow in those footsteps.
But did he fully not want to, or was it...
No, he really
did. Or did he protest too much?
No, he really didn't want it.
Yeah. Then why did he yield?
Because he was a strong party man, and as Roosevelt said, you tell that contrary Missouri mule if he wants to break up the Democratic Party in the middle of a war, in the middle of an election, then let that be on his conscience.
Of course, he had made his reputation running what was unofficially known as the Truman Committee, which was a body to investigate corruption and fraud
in the war effort.
In the war effort, war procurement, war industry, so
yes. And which was a very tricky line for him to tread because, after all, it was his own administration and his own president, Democratic president, who was the commander-in-chief. And inevitably, he was going to run into problems and embarrassments and snarls and or even scandal of a kind that would embarrass the president.
Yeah. Now, what is the very date of Roosevelt's sudden death?
April 12, 1945.
And that is after VE Day, is it not?
No.
It's before VE.
It's before VE Day.
Before victory in Europe.
Yes, VE Day was May 8th.
Well, of course, Hitler took great heart. I remember now that Roosevelt had died. That was the sign from destiny that Germany's fortunes would revive.
Yes.
So he didn't quite interpret that correctly.
Well, 1945 is one of the most traumatic of all years. I think it's not only one of the most important year of the 20th century, I think it's one of the most important years of all time. Because not only did this most calamitous of all wars come to end, but all the leadership changed. Roosevelt died, Hitler died, killed himself. Mussolini was hung up like a pig. And
Churchill is discharged by the British electorate.
Discharged. The atomic bomb is used. The Holocaust is revealed. I mean, the world would never be the same again. And, of course, the post-war world begins. And Truman, this fellow who had so little experience of any kind and who had been told almost nothing by the president. It wasn't just that Roosevelt didn't tell him anything about the atomic bomb. He didn't tell him anything about anything.
One of the most fascinating guests we've ever had on this program. Every time he comes by, and he's been here for every one of his last six or seven books, a new one is coming in just a few months, and he is scheduled to appear again. If you've got a call that you want to put through by way of asking a quick question or making a quick comment response to any of these clips, feel very free to do that. The lines are open. The number is, of course, 312-591-7200. 312-591-7200. We'll be right back to more clips, including coming up next, a conversation with Margaret Thatcher. And there's an interesting story that goes with that particular clip, which I will share with you right after the update on the evening's news from Paula Cooper.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
One of the most interesting of all the world leaders or former world leaders who's ever come on this program, and we've had loads of former secretaries of state and former foreign ministers, both from England and France, and one or two former presidents, but one of the most fascinating of all was Margaret Thatcher, for all sorts of obvious reasons. Here she is in a conversation that goes back to someplace in the, I'm not quite sure when, but shortly after her retirement and the appearance of her first book. So that puts it in the late 1990s, I do believe. Margaret Thatcher on Extension 720.
Good evening. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. A very famous quote from Mrs. Thatcher was when you first met with Mikhail Gorbachev and you sent out an early signal that, I believe your quote was something effect of, we can do business with this man. Yeah. And I'm wondering what you noticed in that meeting or in your negotiations with him behind closed doors that saw or that convinced you that he was more open and perhaps more reasonable than his predecessors.
You're quite right about what I said. This is a man we can do business with. And I phoned Ron Reagan to say just that. He was quite different from any other politician from the Soviet Union I'd ever met. He was much more open. He didn't come with a large sheaf of papers on which he consulted every time I asked him a question. He was prepared to debate. He was prepared to admit that the agriculture was not all right in the Soviet Union. Indeed, he said to me, and he'd come down to check us, and being through a rather nice agricultural country, he said, you know, something like 30% of our agricultural produce never gets to the markets. First, because there's not proper storage, and secondly, because sometimes it disappears in transit. So I thought this was an entirely different man, and then we discussed, obviously, the matter of SDI, and he said to me, will I please try to persuade Ron Reagan to come off SDI? I said, certainly not. I'm supporting it vigorously, and I'm not, in fact, a mediator between the Soviet Union and the United States. I'm the best friend of the United States, and he took that. And we went on discussing, not merely for 2 hours, but something like 4 or 5 hours, and constantly debating. And I'd never come across that in any Soviet Union politician before. He had a small notebook only, which he consulted with one or two notes in. A totally different, more younger, more vibrant, but very loyal to his superiors, and just totally different. And if a man was prepared to admit the shortcomings of the Soviet Union, and they were grievous, then there was the basis on which we really could make progress together.
Our thanks to that caller. That gives me occasion to ask you about the Soviet Union today. You've got some very critical things to say about the attitudes of the West towards the present leadership in the Soviet Union. You do say them in a chapter towards the end of this book.
President Yeltsin, I'm deeply distressed that the Russians have used their army against Chechnya. It is absolutely unforgivable. It's just really alerts one to the fact that some of the mindset is still there. It's also very difficult for them, and yet they have not come to a rule of law. You cannot have a democracy without a rule of law. It is the single most important thing. They're not used to the concept at all. They have not yet really got a stable currency, and they haven't got a rule of law. The currency is better than it was, but even now, there's no way in which you can, if you purchase land, there's no way in which you can see your title to it enforced in any courts. All of these things, you will not get a full democracy unless you give attention to these things. But the most worrying thing is there's still the mindset that they're dominant, and if there are Russians in a large minority in any of the other states, they could go in to defend them or see that they're all right.
Do we in the West have any leverage or any influence over that at all?
Not a great deal, except that I think we should be very slow to have them any further into a partnership, where they have a partnership for peace, but certainly not into NATO. And I believe that we should get the East European countries into NATO. We fought the war to get Poland back to freedom and Czechoslovakia, and now they want to come into NATO, and we should have taken them in. And now, because Russia is saying no, we've just shied away from it. We simply can't be dominated at this stage by that. We should take these people in. They need to have the assurance that if they were attacked, NATO would come to their aid.
I said that's from the 1990s. Obviously, that's not so, because Gorbachev is still coming up. And in fact, by 1990, he was displaced and was out of power. I think that's in the early to mid-1980s, in fact. Either way, it's a memorable night. I said there's a little story attached to it. That was all, of course, set up by the publishers of her then-new memoir. And they also said they wanted her staff required a dinner for her to be served at the radio station because she had a very busy day. And we would just have a dinner served for her before she went on the air. They, the publishers, would pay for it. So I, please lay on a good dinner, said the publicist in New York. So I called Mary Beth Lucioni, who runs Le Nomade, which is really one of the best restaurants in all the world, and surely in Chicago. And she arranged it all and came over with a staff of two or three people, and they were going to serve this wonderful thing. The total group who came along were probably 8 or 10 people, a few people from Scotland Yard, a few local cops, a few probably American Secret Service, and one or two directly on the staff of Mrs. Thatcher, who by then was already retired from the premiership. But the dinner was served. It looked really great. And all Mrs. Thatcher wanted was a bowl of consommé, which really disappointed some of the people who had come over from the fine restaurant. But everybody else really jumped in, and they all had a very good dinner, including Sergeant Rosemary Gottlieb, who was the head of the new Scotland Yard contingent. And she was a very attractive, rather statuesque, a tall woman who reminded me of nothing so much as a character possibly in one of the Ian Fleming 007 novels. But that's another story for another time. But that leads me in a way to movies. And see if you could identify, see if you know who the actor is that I'm talking to in this next clip. In fact, if you do know, phone it in at 312-591-7200. If you get in there before we even finish the clip, if you recognize the voice, why, we will put you on the air. 312-591-7200.
You married DeMille's adopted daughter.
Yes. And he was always worried that my tribe was going to show up on his front lawn somewhere.
When you speak of your tribe, you're talking about all your Mexican relatives from East...
No. He thought I was Indian. I had convinced him to get the part. I had convinced him that I was that I was Cheyenne. And
he really did.
And he was very much surprised to hear me speak in English, because the whole thing was that the casting director had promised him to get a real Cheyenne Indian to come and play the part. And... And so I convinced him that I was Cheyenne.
Well, you know, that raises one very funny thing about you, and one very, very particular thing about you. You are sort of the all-purpose ethnic, and not even ethnic, you're the all-purpose exotic. You've been just about everything. You've been American, of course, as well, in films.
Exotic, I love that. I played some of those exotic parts in Sinbad the Sailor and those.
Yeah?
Yes.
And you, of course, you're a Greek in Zorba. You are a Mexican, probably more than once, but certainly in Zapata.
Yes.
You were an Indian in more than that, the Plainsman.
Oh, yes.
I've seen you as an Eskimo in a wonderful film, whose name I don't quite remember.
No,
you can't remember it either, because we talked about that before we went on the air. And what else have you been, Banash? You've been a Greek twice. You've also been the Onassis character.
I was a Russian. I played the Pope.
Of course you did, in The Shoes of the Fisherman. And, of course, you were an Arab in Lawrence of Arabia.
That I did.
An Arab chief.
Three times I played an Arab.
What were the other two?
Muhammad. And,
you played Muhammad?
Yes, I played Muhammad, and I played...
Oh, wonderful. I don't remember
I
that.
I played, from the Pope to Muhammad. But I cover all my sons.
You haven't managed Jehovah yet.
Well, let's talk about my playing Jehovah.
You're just about right.
Yes. But... then I played Chinese, I played Japanese. I think I've covered it pretty well.
That makes my point, doesn't it?
I've played French, I played Gauguin.
Gauguin, right. Yes. Wonderful. In Lust for Life.
Yes.
With Kirk Douglas.
Yes.
Well, that
he was marvelous.
Yes, but you got the Academy Award.
Well, that doesn't mean that he wasn't marvelous.
No, he was definitely, of course not.
Let's take one quick call for somebody who can and has correctly identified that guest from rather a while ago. Good evening.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Who is that?
My name is Anthony.
And who were we talking to?
Anthony in Glenview. Oh, we were talking to Anthony Quinn. I'm sorry.
Yes, to the other Anthony.
Yes.
Anthony Quinn, of course. Yes, sir, go ahead.
I think, wasn't he an accomplished artist, also a painter?
Yes, he was, apparently. Okay. He's a man of many parts and a very interesting fellow. Thank you, sir, for the call. We now pause for the usual reasons. And then I think another mystery guest from the movies. But first this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
So let's try another, can you identify this guest? This is another actor, actress, one would have said a few years ago, well known to all, I would say. And if you know who she is, buzz in as quickly as you can. 312-591-7200. 312-591-7200.
What kind of director was Wells? I've just made mention of Touch of Evil. We did a program only recently in which we discussed with their authors. We drew from three recent books on film, and one of them was a close study of the films of, one film, of Citizen Kane, by a film scholar down at the University of Illinois. You seem to, you only give a few pages on this, but you represent him as a consummate master, knowing exactly what he wanted, and rather an old dear, easy to get along with.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, for us.
Which isn't the conventional picture of Wells the director.
Well, not so easy for the studio. To me, he was like an unharnessed genius, is what I feel about him. And the problem with that is that unless you're putting up the money, you have to play the game a little bit, you know, and he just couldn't do it. He started out, he lulled the studio into a sense that, oh, he's going to behave now, and he shot the first 4 days' schedule in one day. Brilliantly. And they were just going, oh, boy, he's on track. I mean, he's fine. And then we went on vacation down to Venice, not Italy, but Venice, California.
Yeah.
And before it was renovated and became the beautiful Venice, California, it was not very pretty. It was
he found a nice dilapidated border town in Venice, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. It was an unfortunate place.
Mm-hmm.
And we were supposed to spend, I think, a week down there shooting at night. We finished the picture down there at night.
Mm-hmm.
Every time he would go and he'd see what he thought was, a very dramatic setting. And he would write a scene for him, you know.
That's how we got Marlene Dietrich into the film.
Exactly.
He saw a dilapidated old house that he wanted in the film, so he made it the local brothel.
Yeah.
And made her the madam.
Yeah. And then near there was the motel where, you know, Mercedes McCambridge was there when they kidnapped me. I want to watch. Oh, that was so evil. It was so bad.
She wants to watch what they're going to do to you.
Yeah, tell me.
And let's go quickly to Tom, who knows who that was. Who was it?
Hi, this is Tom. That was Janet Leigh.
Yes, of course. A lovely woman she was.
That was a great movie that she was in with Charlton Heston, Orson Welles.
Touch of Evil.
Touch of Evil, yeah. Great movie.
Thank you, sir, for the call.
Thank you.
And here's a real change of pace for you. You remember the name John Ehrlichman, one of the close associates and assistants to a fellow called Nixon, who used to be president of the United States. Ehrlichman was one of the few Watergate people who served a lengthy time in federal prison, about 2.5 years at least. May not sound like a long time, but I'm sure if you're on the inside, it is. And then he did a book, and he came on this program a long time ago, to be sure, with some fascinating things. Here's a quick excerpt.
It has come clear to me that at the center of our problem was none other than Richard Nixon, who could not bring himself to step out at an appropriate time. And to me, the appropriate time would have been the earliest feasible time, and make a full disclosure of what everybody knew. It would have been possible for him to call together the campaign chairman, the operating heads of his campaign, the people in the White House, Dean and the others who had involved themselves in this, and said, I want to know everything, I need to know everything everybody in this room knows about this episode. And I don't want anybody to hold anything back. And just gone around the table. And then gone right from there to the press office and said to the press, okay, here's as much as I know about this. What I do about it, I don't know yet. I'm going to think about it overnight. Some of these people I think I'm going to have to fire. Some of them certainly have not conducted themselves according to my standards. But the whole thing is an open book as far as I'm concerned. If any of you have any questions at any time, I'm available to you. We're going to get to the bottom of this.
He should have done that, but he didn't, is what you're saying.
That's right.
Hypothesis. And the reason he didn't?
The reason he didn't, I think, is because he suspected that John Mitchell was involved.
I want to give you another hypothesis.
All right.
The reason he didn't may be that he himself was involved. That accusation has never been clearly or strongly leveled, but it does not seem to me inconceivable that he was in on the original operation. He had given some kind of approval. A report had been made to him about the intention to go into Democratic National Committee headquarters, and he had said, okay.
Well, I can't rule it out. The only thing I can say is I don't know of any evidence of that.
No, I don't either.
And certainly the tapes were scoured, and presumably only the critical ones, the ones that had any evidence in them, were used. And I doubt that there are any that were hidden or anything of that kind.
Well, we've got a famous missing 18 minutes and one or two tapes that could not be found.
I don't know. You know, I don't know how that occurred either. But in any event, I think. I said I thought at the root of it was the fact that Nixon feared that Mitchell was involved. There's another thing, and that is that Richard Nixon simply emotionally and psychically was incapable of delivering himself or his people to his enemies.
And he felt he had a lot of those.
Oh, sure.
Nice fella, actually. I found myself quite impressed by John Ehrlichman against all of my expectations. And he was here once or twice after that particular occasion. That, as I say, was shortly after he got out of prison had written a novel, or what they call a roman à clé, very much based on his years with Nixon and on Nixon as the agitated, brilliant, but somehow paranoid president. A last challenge. Here are actors, all male actors, all of whom have appeared on this program. Can you quickly identify them? And we'll hope to work in a quick phone call identifying them at 312-591-7200.
When Lucas realized he wanted a dark, more bass voice, he probably thought of Orson Welles, and then he eventually asked me if I wanted the day's work, and I said, yeah, and we went in and did it in 2.5 hours.
And there was Clifford Odets looking like an intelligent Albert Einstein. Very aquiline features, hair bushy, with a blanket over his shoulder and a typewriter. And he'd say, come here, kid. And I'd walk over to his shoulder, and he says, this is your next line. And I saw him type out, the cat's in the bag and the bag's in the river.
I thought Letter to Three Wives was a good movie. I thought Champion, which I suppose made me a star, was a very, very interesting movie, which holds up very well. Mm. I thought working with Willie Wilder on Detective Story, Ace in the Hole, Bad and the Beautiful, Lust for Life. Well, I start to run out of movies that I like.
And the father says to the son, in my day, there were things that were done, and there were things that were not done. And there was even a way of doing those things that were not done. And that is the whole Victorian ethic, I think.
Well, for there to be a finish to the story, she has to come back, and indeed she did. And she said, Mr. Garraway, so I said, what? She said, I just want you to know, sir, that because of your attitude, neither my friend nor I will ever watch you again. So his ratings dropped shortly thereafter.
Don't there be players that I've seen play and heard of his praise, and that highly, not to speak it profanely, but neither having the accent of Christians nor the gait of Christian, pagan, nor man, have so strutted and bellowed that I've thought some of nature's journeymen had made men and not made them well. They imitated humanity so abominably.
That's the full list. We've got some callers, but they haven't named all of them, and time is too short, I suppose, to test that out on the phone. So I will identify them in the order in which you heard them, and they were all clips from programs that each of these men did with us on Extension 720. They were first Tony Curtis. No, I beg your pardon. First James Earl Jones, then Tony Curtis, then Kirk Douglas, then Peter Ustinov, then Steve Allen, who counts as an actor. He had some acting roles as well as his own presiding over a great talk show at the beginning of the talk show phase of American television. And we ended with Charlton Heston with the Player King speech from Hamlet. We are out of time. If you want to really catch some of our old programs and also recent ones in full 2-hour length, you go to WGNradio.com/extension720. We will be back tomorrow night with a live program, though coming at 11 o'clock, 11 to midnight. Until then, thanks to all for listening and a most cordial good night.